Today's reading comes from a book on cross-cultural religious studies, A History of Religion and 5½ Objects by S. Brent Plate. This is a passage about how stones and rocks function as religious symbols in Japan. Very few places in the world cherish, use, and in many cases deify stones as in Japan. Japanese gardens are rife with indications of the potency, vitality, and cosmic significance of stones as they merge ancient Shinto practices and beliefs with Buddhism. Within the indigenous traditions of Shinto, otherwise known as the Way of the Kami, are many gods and goddesses. These include spirits of the ancestors who have died and passed on, deities of storms, fire, the sun, and the sea, gods of longevity, and foods like rice, and patrons of vocations such as swordsmiths, musicians, and peddlers. The kami also inhabit rocks and stones. Various Shinto shrines exist across Japan, built upon more ancient geologically natural manifestations of the kami-like trees and hills and rocks. Shinto traditions eventually influenced the later Buddhist gardens. As Buddhist practices and ideas began to grow across Japan, the stones and shrines to the deities in nature did not disappear, but changed forms to meet new ways of seeing and being. For example, dry stone gardens. Under the aesthetic austerity of Zen, stone and rock generate an impression of ponds, streams, and waterfalls.
Thank you, Nikki. It was such a privilege for me to be in Japan this summer and to experience many things that felt very different from what I was used to. For example, one thing I didn't expect, I knew that sitting on the floor was a thing in Japan. I never realized how much I would miss my living room couch. But also, I did get to experience so many things that felt very deeply connected to the life that we all share here. And so today, I would like to share with you three moments from our trip when I felt most connected to the life of the Spirit. One moment that I expected might happen, one that caught me by surprise, and one that just made me laugh at myself. Also, in one way or another, in keeping with the reading Nikki shared, all of these moments involve stones or rocks. The first moment was at the rock garden at Ryo-anji Buddhist Temple in Kyoto, which is one of the most famous Zen gardens in the world. The slide shows, this is the garden at Ryo-anji. Ryo-anji is a dry rock garden of the kind that Nikki was reading to us about. The Japanese term for this kind of garden is kare sansui, literally dry mountain water. The gravel, which as you see is raked with tremendous care and precision, like don't you dare step on that gravel, don't do it. The gravel represents water, and the rocks represent mountains or islands coming up out of the water. This garden is several centuries old. It contains 15 rocks arranged in groupings on beds of moss, and of course this very elegant, precise gravel. One thing about Ryo-anji is that wherever you go, from whatever point you view it, there is always at least one rock which is hidden from view. There's always something that cannot be seen, and there's something evocative about that. We might ask, what does this garden mean? What does this pattern of stones mean? It's been arranged with such deliberate care. But over the centuries, those who care for this garden have really refused to say it means one thing over another. It resists any one interpretation, so that whoever comes to Ryoanji is invited to find their own meaning in it. And the people who come here to this garden are many and from many places. Busloads of people from all different countries pour in every day to see this garden. And why? Well, some people are probably just along for the ride, and that's fine. But a lot of people come to Ryoanji looking for something. I want to show you the next image. This is an image of the people who happened to be sitting in the garden, sharing the garden with me at the moment that I was able to be there. And I must say, Nikki, if you want to go sit and look at the slides, that might be, I would if I were you. So what touched me most at Ryoanji were, in fact, these fellow travelers. It felt like we were all there as fellow seekers, watching, waiting, listening for some kind of word of wisdom from these rocks and stones that have been there for a very long time. I hoped, and even dared to expect, that maybe I might receive some message at Ryoanji that I needed to hear. And so I want to offer to you what I did here as I looked at this garden with all these other fellow human beings. For me, and this is only my experience, but I looked at the gravel, and in the moment, it seemed to me that each little bit of gravel was like a person. And it was like there was this whole sea of people trying not to drown because they couldn't find the land. In the Buddhist tradition, there is often this image, a spiritual metaphor, of people who are desperate for a boat or a bridge to help them reach the shore of land and safety. That image came into my mind, and it seemed to me that there was an invitation for all of us to really commit to our own spiritual, ethical work so that we do not have to drown in the sea, which represents all the difficulties of life, all the hardships that we all go through, imaged by these rocks, trying to find a spiritual foundation like these rocks that rise up out of the water and promise us safety and solid ground. And so what I felt at Ryoanji was this very strong invitation to continue with my spiritual practice and encourage all of you to do the same, whatever that is for you, so that we can find our way for ourselves and also lead other people to those places of safety and ultimately, in fact, to become that solid ground for other people. The Buddhist tradition teaches that the awakened mind is a refuge for self and for others, a place of safety and deep grounding. And I have never felt that more than at this incredible garden of stone and rock, Ryoanji. So the second moment I'd like to share with you comes from an even deeper strand of the Japanese religious tradition. Shintoism, as you may know, is much, much older than Buddhism in Japan. The fundamental teaching of Shintoism is that everything is alive. There are spirits in everything, and especially in nature, in the trees and rivers and stones of the natural world. Shinto shrines help people connect with those spirits, or kami, as they're called in Japan. And particular shrines are considered to be the homes of particular kami. So while we were in Japan, I had the chance to visit a Shinto shrine, the Tsubaki Grand Shrine, which has a wonderful connection with Unitarian Universalism. Does anybody know about this? I'm so excited to tell you about it. About 50 years ago, the president of the seminary I went to, Meadville Lombard Theological School, struck up a friendship with the chief priest at this shrine. I'm not sure exactly how that happened, but the details are a little fuzzy. But they got to be really good friends, and out of that, came a program for Unitarian Universalist ministerial students to go over to the Tsubaki Grand Shrine as exchange students to learn more about Shinto. And this program for students has been going on for many years. Currently, several ministerial students go every year still. And so, of course, I wanted to visit as well. I've heard many people talk about their experiences and how much they enjoyed the shrine. So John and I, my husband John and I, went, and they welcomed us with such warmth. First of all, I just want to say getting to know them was so delightful. Here's a picture. Let's see. This is a picture of John and me, as well as the gentleman in the center is the chief priest. He was really nice. And as well as the other gentleman is Ochiai-san. He was another priest at the shrine who was also our translator. And the fifth person is one of the UU students who was visiting the shrine at that time. Her name is Jamie, she's from New Jersey. So we had this enormous dinner. It was one of those dinners where they bring you a couple courses and you eat and it's delicious. And then they bring you a couple more and you eat those and you're getting pretty full. And then they bring out like five more. It's just like, oh my goodness. So they were so wonderful to us. And by the way, one of my favorite memories of the trip was, at the Tsubaki Grand Shrine, when you take a picture, they don't have us say cheese, they have us say Tsubaki. So that's what we're all saying. It was really fun. The next day, we got to participate in the morning worship, and they gave us the really great honor in their culture of being able to stand before the place where their most sacred kami are enthroned and offer a prayer there. That was such a mark of affection and respect for Unitarian Universalists. It touched my heart. The feel of the place was very beautiful to me. If you want to just glance at your order of service, you will see the main entrance gate to the shrine. There's a big, what they call a torii gate, the style of gate which has two pillars and then the beams at the top. That marks the entrance into sacred space. And you can see that there's a sort of a forest path leading up to the main shrine building. So the slide is showing us the main building of the shrine. That's where they have their worship services. Can you get a sense of how connected these human-built structures are to the natural world? It's just an interweaving. Without the forest, there would be no shrine. And it made me think that I'm very glad that we also have a worship space that honors the trees. We can just be with the trees as we worship, just as they can. Of everything that I saw and experienced that day, there's one thing that I particularly want to share with you. And so what you're looking at now is the image of a small shrine, which is down the hill from the main hall at Tsubaki. And I learned that it had been put there as a shrine for people who are suffering from illness, and in particular, mental illness. And there was something about that. I thought, what a beautiful idea to establish this place of prayer, especially for people who are suffering so much. Another thing that touched me is one thing I found out that in Japan, often when you're in public spaces or in places of worship, there really aren't places to sit down. It's just not part of the culture. You just stand. And we learned that this was the only place in the whole shrine complex where a bench had been provided for people to sit. And there was something about that that just really touched my heart, that someone thought ahead and thought, the people who are going to come to this shrine are going to need a place to sit down and rest. So that was just a beautiful moment. And so I felt moved to sit down and offer some prayers for people I know. And I want to share this closer view with you. I wonder if you can see the way the rocks, at the very center, these are rocks. And you see, they have sort of a human shape to them. The keepers of the shrine believe that there are kami, spirits, who live here in the rocks and who hear people's prayers and will help them. What I can say is that to me, sitting there, the rocks felt very old, and very charged with an energy that was powerful and benevolent. I think it was a place where healing might be possible. I did not expect to come across this place, but it really was extraordinary. I hope that if you also are ever able to visit Japan, I hope that you can go and visit this beautiful shrine, which was just so welcoming to us, both as Unitarian Universalists and as human beings. I know that if you will go there, you will find a warm welcome. Well, really, we were so fortunate on this trip. We saw so many shrines, so many temples. We met wonderful people. We stayed at Airbnbs along the way, and we just had such fun with those folks. We ate a lot of really good seafood. We drank a lot of tea. We walked all over. We saw bamboo. We saw beautiful art. It was incredible. But still, and this is the last thing I want to tell you about, still, I found myself, let's say, grasping after certain particular kinds of experience that I really wanted to have while I was there. And specifically, I really wanted to see the iconic view of Mount Fuji at a distance. Can we have the slide? So this is the only image in the service that I did not take myself. Well, you've probably seen pictures of this, something like this. This is Mount Fuji, or Fujisan, as it is known in Japanese. Japanese people call it Fujisan as if they were addressing a person with respect. This is the highest mountain in Japan. It is a dormant volcano, which may not always be dormant, for the moment it is. And it is, of course, one of the most sacred sites in the country. I was really excited to see this view of Mount Fuji. I had the feeling that seeing the mountain like this would make my journey complete, that I'd really seen what I came to see. Do you know what I'm saying? But what I actually discovered is that most of the time you can't see the mountain at all because it's completely surrounded by clouds almost every single day. Nobody told me that. My picture-perfect spiritual moment proved to be quite elusive. I should have known from Japanese poetry, the 17th century poet Basho might have tipped me off with this haiku. He wrote, "In the misty rain, Mount Fuji is veiled all day." How intriguing. Intriguing indeed. I was determined to see this mountain. So the first thing we did when we got to the Mount Fuji region, in fact, was to take a bus halfway up the mountain, halfway up Mount Fuji, to the first main climbing station. My husband, John, had one single purpose in mind, which was to climb to the top and down, which he did. I'm so proud of him. I decided in the end that I couldn't do it. I chickened out, which was the right choice for me, having heard about his very painful experience. But he was happy. I was happy that I didn't go. But what I did at this hiking station on the mountain was I took this wonderful hike. It turns out that there is this path, in addition to the paths that go like up, there's also a path that winds around the mountain just at, you know, at one same constant elevation. You can walk quite a bit. And so I want to show you, oh, there it is already. This is an image of the really beautiful trail that I was able to walk. Just beautiful, misty trees, very old forests. It was gorgeous. I also had a total blast saying hi to the tons and tons of Japanese children on field trips who completely were all over this trail. So I'd be walking along, I'd go like, "Konnichiwa," which is like one of my few phrases. And they would be like, "Hello." They were awesome, it was really cool. So that was my day on Mount Fuji. It was really fun. Over the next few days, however, I pursued my quest to see the mountain from a distance. Here is a shot, if we could. This is a shot of what is reported to be a stunning view of Mount Fuji from a mountainside scenic vista point near the resort town of Hakone. What do you see? Do you see Mount Fuji? No. Clouds. But I swear, the mountain's right there. You just couldn't see it. Okay. Not to be daunted, the next day, I dragged John to a park and up a hillside to a spot that was supposed to offer another amazing view of Mount Fuji. Here it is. It's a blue sky, right? You should be able to see the mountain. Can you see the mountain? No. No, not at all. John, by the way, was not really thrilled about climbing all the way up this hill because he was still recovering from his climb up the mountain 2 days previously. So it goes, yeah. Well, that really was my last chance on this trip to see the view of Mount Fuji at a distance, which I had become kind of obsessed with. And in the end, I really just had to laugh at myself. First, because I was so obviously grasping after this experience that was not going to happen, even in the midst of all these amazing things that were happening. Isn't that just such a human thing? We get so focused on what we want, we lose sight of the blessings that are actually there. And then I started laughing even harder because the truth was, what was I even talking about? I had already seen the mountain. I mean, I had literally stood on the side of Mount Fuji and seen it. Like, you can't get closer than I was at. I touched it. I walked on it. What else was I even looking for? What kind of experience was I hoping to have that I had not already had? And then I remembered, there is a classic spiritual textbook from the medieval period in England called The Cloud of Unknowing. We don't know who wrote this text, maybe a priest, maybe a monk. Anyway, it was someone deeply committed to the practice of contemplative prayer, sitting in silence and trying to hear the voice of God. And the author says, he's writing, or she is writing, to advise others who wish to pursue this practice of contemplative prayer. And the author says, the first time you practice contemplation, you'll only experience a darkness like a cloud of unknowing. You won't know what this is. You'll only know that in your will you feel a simple reaching out to God. You must also know that this darkness and this cloud will always be between you and your God, whatever you do. So be sure you make your home in this darkness. It's the closest you can get to God on this earth by living in this darkness and in this cloud. So, okay, there's a metaphor going on here. This is a spiritual teaching, but it did strike me that maybe literally waiting in clouds was what I was supposed to be doing